Hey, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Aaron Seary, managing partner of Seary & Glimstad, and for 15 years, the lawyer who's been cross-examining the American public health establishment. Aaron's the attorney behind the famous 9-hour deposition of Stanley Plotkin, the man they call the godfather of vaccines. Aaron's fought over 100 lawsuits to force the FDA and CDC to open their files. And he's been called the legal engine behind the biggest shakeup in vaccine policy in our lifetime. His new book is called Vaccines, Amen, The Religion of Vaccines. And it starts with a simple observation. People say, I believe in vaccines. Nobody says that about seatbelts. So today, we're not doing medical advice. I'm not a doctor. We're doing what this show always does. We're asking how you know what's real when you're not allowed to check. Aaron Seary, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. How are you?
Good. Good to be here, Cedric.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into this. Obviously, it's a health, this show is the Bitcoin Matrix, but I think in a lot of ways, health, you know, is wealth, and wealth equals health. And I think a lot of people actually maybe kind of go against their own health priorities to obtain wealth, you know, whether it's, sleepless nights and stress and anxiety. So there's a big connection between health and wealth. But I'd love to get into you and your background and, you know, kind of how this deposition with the godfather of vaccines came to be, how you kind of came to the forefront of all this.
I got a phone call from the doctor who was on the other side representing the mother who wanted to continue not vaccinating a child in what was a custody, essentially a family law proceeding. So the parents had not been vaccinating this child. The mother, then they were getting divorced. The mother wanted to continue what they had been doing, which is not vaccinating. The father decided to change his mind because his views changed, because he wants leverage, whatever. Who knows? So a doctor was brought in as an expert on behalf of the mother. And then the other side brought in Dr. Stanley Plotkin, who, you know, at the time this case was getting national news attention. And I guess there was a group out there, a big proponent of vaccines, that thought, oh, this is an opportunity to educate the world about how amazing vaccines are. And who better to do that than the world's leading vaccinologist, Dr. Stanley Plotkin. So they brought him in as an expert on behalf of the father. And that's when Dr. Tony Bark called me and said, hey, do you want to depose Dr. Stanley Plotkin? I had been doing some vaccine work up at that point. And so that's the genesis.
And I guess, did you ever think that this would become a primary focus of sort of your career in terms of all the other kinds of class actions and lawsuits your firm handles?
No. I probably would have laughed and fallen out of my chair when I was, you know, in law school if you told me that, you know, while I was when I was in Berkeley for law school, or when I clerked for a year after that, or when I clerked for the Chief Judge of the Supreme Court of Israel for a year after law school. And then I would have laughed then. I would have laughed during my first years working at Latham Watkins, representing some of the biggest financial interests in the country. I represented, for example, Goldman Sachs when I was there in a number of matters. And other financial institutions, and, you know, some of the critical bet the company kind of litigation or otherwise critical, you know, litigations. All I do is litigation. I would have laughed then, but, but here I am. That's what it's part of what my firm does, a big part of what my firm does. We have about, 50 people that do vaccine-related work at my firm. We do a lot of other stuff. We have, you know, well over 100 people at the firm, but that is a significant component of what we do these days. And we don't represent pharmaceutical companies. So as far as I know, we have the largest vaccine-related practice in the world that doesn't represent pharma companies.
And then maybe going up to the deposition, what was preparation like? Did you have to prepare differently for this kind of deposition?
Not really. I mean, I just read. we were going in. This is a child with zero, you know, zero of these products. They were bringing in, and I treated it just like I would any other product, right? If this was about Goodyear tires, and the question was, is the Goodyear tire safe to put on this particular type of car or not? Is this type of building material fine to put in these walls? Is that going to cause problems or not? I prepared in the same way. And how would you do that? You go and you look at what is available, what reliable data is available with regards to that product, right? The thing is that what makes the, you know, legal proceedings around vaccines so incredible is that people don't treat them like a product. They treat them like some article of faith, like some you know, holy vesicle to be worshipped. And, you know, oh, no, you can't. You can't raise any question, no questions kind of allowed situation. But fortunately, I didn't view it that way. I just viewed it as the way it should be viewed, which is you're going to come in and say this child needs all vaccines. Fine. Then I need you to affirm to me that these products are safe and that the safety outweighs, you know, that the safety is such that the benefits outweigh the risks. And I mean, I left that deposition after 9 hours because I didn't go in there thinking like, oh, you know, this is a slam dunk. No way. I did not go into that deposition that way. I went in having read everything that I could that was publicly available about each of these products on the FDA website, on the CDC website, from the manufacturer, really going down to the primary sources, not just taking the conclusory assertions at their face value. Because, of course, every company that promotes a product, and including a public government agency, yeah, they'll tell you it's great, but what's under the hood? And I will say after 9 hours, I would say that the worst fears raised about whether or not these products were properly studied before licensure, after licensure, and so forth, was not only met, it was worse than I actually, or I think even those who raised the biggest concerns about vaccines, that's what I left with. So, you know, no twists, no turns, no information where I was like, oh, okay, now I see why they licensed that vaccine in this ridiculous trial. None of that. And anybody who wants can watch all 9 hours of it, and you can judge for yourself whether or not Dr. Plotkin had every fair opportunity to answer those questions and provide additional proof and evidence. He knew what he was walking into. I think that anybody that really listens and watches it objectively walks away very, very concerned about the childhood vaccine regimen in our country.
Well, you outlined a lot of it in the book, and I was reading through some of the cross deposition, or, you know, his testimony. I mean, how would you describe his answers on two different planks? One on, I mean, in a court or in deposition, you're building evidence-based arguments. So you had questions about the data, and then you also had questions about his funding. And how would you sort of characterize his answers to those?
Well, I'll start with the funding part, and then I'll answer the data part. So on the funding part, you know, only in a deposition about vaccines would anybody dare bring in an expert that has received endless amounts of money from the very company who profits to the tune of billions from the product at issue in the deposition. Imagine I walked into a deposition about, you know, again, let's go with Goodyear car tires, and I walk in, and they bring their objective, impartial expert that's intended to persuade the judge and jury that the Goodyear tires are safe and have no issues, because they're supposed to be an impartial expert. And my very first question is, so have you ever gotten any prior funding from Goodyear? They would never say yes, because Goodyear lawyer would never hire an expert like that. Have you ever been a consultant for Goodyear? Have you ever been on their board? Have you ever... you know, basically of every type of conflict you could imagine, they're like, oh, forget it. This guy's totally biased. And no jury would take incredible. And I've never seen that in any other area, right? You don't go into an asbestos deposition of, and you know, where a company's going, no, the asbestos didn't cause that, you know, that case of, you know, of cancer. And the expert for the company that made the asbestos product worked for that company. It would never happen. It would just be laughed. You'd be laughed. It would probably even be malpractice by the lawyer to do it. okay? But it, only in this space do they do ridiculous things like that, because they're so blind about these products. They don't even think of them as products. Hence why I call my book. So Stanley Plotkin, it took me like 2 hours just to begin to touch on all the conflict. 2 hours. You know, he's basically received money or sat on the board or has an incestuous tie to every single pharmaceutical company that's involved with vaccines that I could find. I couldn't find one that he's not. He has sat on the board or been a consultant or been an employee or received all kinds of fees from everyone in one form or another, one of those at least, from each of the four major manufacturers of childhood vaccines that he was sitting there testifying, this child should be injected with. Those made by Merck, Pfizer, Sanofi, and GlaxoSmithKline, GSK. I mean, so that's the first part. Yeah, that part is incredible. And it's reflective of the culture, the way that these products are viewed. It's just that safety is just taken as an assumption in any event. So that's on the conflicts piece, which is incredible. And then on the data side of it, it's also incredible to me because I'll give you one example. Leading up to, so I wanted to go through each of the vaccines. So what's the very first vaccine on the child's schedule? The hepatitis B vaccine, administered on day one of life, okay? And then at 1 month and then 6 months according to the schedule. There's only two licensed hepatitis B vaccines that are given, standalone hepatitis B vaccines, and the only ones that we give into a newborn baby. Combivax HB and Endrix B. Combivax HB, in the FDA documentation, in the package insert, in the underlying documents that I could find, all reflected that this product, given to millions of babies, was licensed to be given to millions of babies, on their first day of life, was licensed based on a clinical trial. And this may sound incredible. Anybody hearing it, go to the FDA website. It's right there. That had 147 kids, 5 days of safety monitoring after injection, and no control group. Forget placebo control. No control group. That's a laughable trial if that's in fact the case, right? And that's all I could find before the deposition. And the reason it's a joke is because, number one, you don't have a control group. What are you comparing against? It's garbage. I mean, I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean that actually scientifically. It's literally useless to determine safety, okay? Even if this trial had a proper control group that received something inert, a placebo, it didn't review safety long enough. 5 days of safety monitoring after injection is, again, laughable. You're giving this to a baby, let alone forget an adult. It's not long enough for an adult, but a baby. You're not going to know what developmental, neurological, immunological issues go down the list until at least a few years in. Those don't manifest often or not diagnosed. Asthma is not diagnosed until a few years of age. Developmental issues are not diagnosed until a few years of age. Go down the list. So you'd have no idea the safety, but 5 days is truly ridiculous. What if 6 days, 7 days later? I mean, often autoimmune issues from vaccines take at least, more than 4-5 days to appear. Okay. And then even if you had a placebo control, and even if you had a safety review for years or at least months, there weren't enough kids in this trial, 147. It's not powered enough to detect anything. So this thing was, any statistician, epidemiologist, there's no one, none on this planet with a straight face that would defend that trial as being anything but junk, okay? And I would love to get into deposition anybody that would try to claim otherwise. That would be a lot of fun. They would never do it. You don't even need to have a science degree to understand that that's junk and not sufficient. Okay. I think a 7-year-old kid will understand what I just said, I believe. Right. And you don't need to have a PhD or an MD or a bachelor's or an associate's. You don't even need a high school diploma to understand what I just said. Okay. It's a joke. So given that it's a joke, I thought, okay, when I'm in this deposition with Dr. Plotkin, surely he will show me that that's not true. There's all this mountain of evidence out there. By the way, if you want to share your screen right now, I could even, before I continue this story, I don't know if you want to. You want to go to the FDA website? We could show your audience that what I just said is true. If you want to.
I would rather just keep the conversation going.
All right, let's go. Okay, so anybody at home, just go to Google, type in FDA licensed vaccines, go down to Recombivax HB, click on the package insert, go to section 6.1. That's a clinical trial relied upon to license it, and you can read what I said for yourself. And if you don't trust that, read the underlying clinical licensure documents. Anyways, so continuing, I get into the deposition, and, you know, I say, Dr. Plotkin, you want to give this product? I said, okay, so we're going to, you know, let's start with the license, the clinical trial to license this product. Because, you know, after it's licensed, they tell you it is unethical to conduct a placebo-controlled trial. So the clinical trial to license it is so important to determine safety. It's incredibly important. And I get into the post-licensure safety as well in the depo, but starting with the clinical trial, the pre-licensure safety, I said, you know, what was that clinical trial? You know, was there a control? How long? So on and so forth. And he doesn't know how long safety was. He doesn't remember, which I found surprising. So I hand him the FDA-approved pharma company drafted package insert, and I said, hey, here it is. You know, and he turns to section 6.1. He's like, oh, it was 5 days of safety monitoring. And if you watch the deposition, what you'll see is he was surprised it was 5 days. And I asked him a bunch of questions about that, including I said, well, number one, I said, is that long enough to determine what happens on the sixth day? And he says, no. And then I said, and now that it's a licensed product, isn't it true that you couldn't do that clinical trial now because it would be considered ethically inappropriate? And he said, yeah, it would be ethically difficult to do it now, right? And I said, and don't you need a clinical trial to determine causation between a claimed injury, right, and the product? And he said, yeah, because for the most part, yes, because that is how you often prove causation. After licensure, they do retrospective epi stuff, which can't prove causation, they said. Okay, so he has nothing to provide that shows it's more than that. After the deposition, I subpoenaed him for any documents. Give him another chance. Give me any documents to show it's more. He still provides nothing. In fact, he took me to court to quash the subpoena. Okay, never produces anything. Then on behalf of the Informed Consent Action Network, ICANN, it's a nonprofit that funds a lot of the vaccine policy work my firm does. We FOIA'd the FDA, that's the Freedom of Information Act. That is the federal law that allows us, the taxpayers, to check on those who work for us, federal government, right? Employees, officials, and so forth. They forget they work for us, but they do. We got to underlying clinical trial documents to see, is this really true? Maybe Plotkin doesn't know, but let's just, and maybe the package insert just like was too short of a summary. So we got the underlying package clinical trial documents, and there it is. No more than less than a week, you know, not enough kids, no control group in the clinical trial, a lot of punctilized for children. There it is in black and white. And you know what was the most surprising piece of it? So it confirmed the worst of it. Guess who was listed as the principal investigator for the clinical trial relied upon to license that vaccine for children? Dr. Stanley Plotkin. So think about that. The very man who was the principal investigator of the clinical trial to license for Combivax HB was Dr. Plotkin. And was the man sitting across from me, I didn't know it at the time, in that room, when I asked him how long was safety reviewed in the clinical trial to license this product, the very man who was the principal investigator didn't even remember. And apparently didn't seem to jive his memory even when he read it in the package insert. And I think that's because safety is such an afterthought to these vaccinologists. It is such an afterthought. They assume safety. It's the same way they would bring that dude in to be their expert. It's because they just assume safety. They don't really need to test it, you know? And so, by the way, we went on to actually petition the FDA on this very topic, on this very product, and say, listen, There's a lot of gray in what is enough to determine a product safe for licensure, but 5 days, 147 kids, no control, no way that qualifies. That's in the black, okay? And we submitted that petition years ago asking them to provide data to show that there is more or require proper trials to license, to, you know, and then reissue the licensure. We still are waiting for a formal response. They had 6 months and we're now 4 years down the road and they still, because they don't have anything. So that gives you a window. So when you talk about the data, that's one little tiny slice of what we're talking about. And just to put a final point on this, what makes the whole thing, everything I just told you so incredible is that this vaccine, Recombivax HB, is the very first recombinant DNA technology vaccine ever licensed in the United States. It was as novel as the mRNA vaccine is today. It was the very first one. There was no thing like, oh, well, we've had a million. No, you didn't. There was no licensed recombinant DNA technology Hep B vaccine, period. Forget Hep B. And then prior to that vaccine, there was never any licensed vaccine for children for Hep B. There was a vaccine licensed in 1981 that used human blood that was licensed for adults and for a newborn potentially to be used, but never for children. That thing was withdrawn pretty quickly from the market. They didn't even use that product as the control. But even if they did, which would have been improper because it wasn't licensed for children, they should have used a proper control. They didn't monitor safety long enough and they didn't. And then if you're like, you know, for all of those out there who are proponents of vaccines, you might be saying to yourself, fine, they didn't do it before licensure, but oh, we have years of data, 30 years of data now, we know it's safe. You'll be crestfallen when you actually understand what the post-licensure literature and landscape, safety landscape looks like. And I go through that in chapter 11 of my book. It's in many ways worse than the conduct in the clinical trials.
Wow. I mean, I was astonished when I was going through the testimony and the deposition with just the I don't knows. How long was the study for? I don't know. Would you believe it was 5 days? I'm not sure. It just, even on the economic side, his financial interest in some things, wouldn't that have been sort of a really large payout for you, maybe the biggest in your life? Do you remember what it was? I don't know. And so
most people remember getting paid $5 million or $3 million or $2 million. They remember that typically.
Yeah, these are pinnacles in people's entrepreneur pursuits. You would think they would remember something of the biggest things that ever happened to them. And a science like mine, you would think they would remember aspects of the biggest study that they would have been a part of, or landmark studies, or such important studies. So yeah, that was strange. Well, what do you make then, or how do you explain sort of the economic calculus or the lack of around product liability of vaccines? And maybe we got to talk about 1986 and the original sin there with what happened in 1986. Can you kind of elaborate on that?
Sure. Given the name of the podcast, I'm assuming a lot of folks who watch this are financially oriented and have a, and so I think this, you know, I this might really strike, even if what I just talked about, the clinical trial data, doesn't. And that's because, you know, when you think of product safety, what drives it? Anybody who thinks the government drives safety, go look at countries that are highly, highly regulated, like the old Soviet Union, right? And have very little free market. And go look how safe their products are. They're not safe. What drives safety is the economic self-interest of the company that makes the product. If they're going to be held accountable and they're going to end up upside down financially, that conforms their conduct accordingly. Okay? And this is... I didn't come up with this. This is just basic market forces. It's elementary. And so when you look around the product landscape, okay, there is no other product in the United States, literally none, where you cannot sue for design defect claim. The claim that had the product been made safer, you or your child would not have been injured or killed, with one exception. There's only one exception to that, and those are vaccines, right? The very product tell you are safe. And the reason that immunity arose, and it was a terrible idea, it's what I call the original sin, what you just said, is that leading up to 1986, when there were only three routine vaccines, that's it, MMR, DTP, and OPV, a child following the CDC schedule in 1986 would have gotten seven shots on or before their first birthday. Excuse me, three shots on or before their first birthday. Three. A child following the CDC schedule today will receive 29 shots on or before their first birthday. So we're talking about a time when there was only three shots on or before the first birthday leading up to 1986. And those products were causing so much harm. It was MMR, DTP, and OPV. That's it. So much harm that the manufacturers were either going out of business or they stopped making them because of the liability that they were experiencing. And to the point where there was only one manufacturer left for each. They were down from like six for the pertussis down to three, six for measles down to one, six for measles down to one, three for polio down to one, or something like that. And now a lot of industries face this crossroad where the product they make is causing more harm than good. And that's measured with dollars. That's the way we do it, right? And it's worked really well for us as a society over the last 50 years. What do industries do at that point? Well, they retool. When they realize asbestos is causing cancer, did Congress go, oh, whoa, wait a second. Houses are really important. Hospitals are really important. Government buildings are really important. So what we're going to do, we're just going to give you immunity, okay? So you can keep selling all these building materials. They used it in everything for building materials because dwellings and structures are so important. We're just going to say nobody can ever sue you for causing cancer from your asbestos product. No, that's intuitively ridiculous. The industry survived. In fact, it's thriving, right? It retooled. It came up with products that were safer, better. And we amazingly still have buildings today, right? When cars were blowing up because their gas tanks had defects in them, we say, oh, cars are really important. We need ambulances. We need to be able to drive tanks down the road. And those things are important. No. The market forces drove them to make better, safer cars, okay? That would have happened with vaccines if Congress didn't butt its nose into this industry, as Congress often does, creating irregularities in a market that's working and doing what it should do. It went in and created something different. It created an artifact that we live with today, which is it passed something called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 that said to these pharma companies, don't worry, it's okay. We're just going to make it in that no matter how many kids you kill, maim, or injure, we're just going to make it so they and their families can't sue you for the harms. We're going to make it that you never actually have to make your product safer. And even if you don't, nobody can hold you accountable for those harms. That is what the 1986 Act did. And they did not only give immunity for those three products, they gave it for any other routine childhood vaccine, including if used by adults, licensed thereafter. And that was the genesis of the explosion of this industry. If you've got a pharmaceutical company and you're looking at what is the next product you want to develop, and you're presented with the following business model, okay? You're going to sell a product. You're going to create a product. You are not going to be held liable for the injuries, so you don't have a lot of downside. The government's going to mandate it, so you have a guaranteed market. The government's going to assure payment if nobody can pay for it, so you're guaranteed a payment. And the government's even going to promote it for you, even though you don't really need it because you got mandates, you got immunity. They're going to even promote it for you. It's a pretty good business model. In fact, if I applied that business model to anything else, you would say, that's a joke, right? You're kidding. What do you mean? We're going to sell a widget, and what's the widget do? Oh, you just inject it into people. What if people don't want it? Don't worry. We're going to mandate it. What if it causes harm? Don't worry. You'll be immune. What if people have an uprising? Don't worry. The government will promote it. You'd be like, that's ridiculous. That can't be. But that is the reality of vaccines. And so what you have is a product where, you know, people like, you don't need to believe in any conspiracy to understand that there is a serious problem with child vaccines. You just have to understand the broken economic and regulatory structure that surrounds them. Here, and I'll give one example of how this structure distorts the way things normally happen with a product. With drugs, a pharmaceutical company is still liable for the injury, right? So Lipitor, go down the list. Which means that before their license, when they're sitting there and their scientists and the folks within the structure of any pharma company is thinking of designing that clinical trial, they also want to have a pretty decent sense of what kind of harms that product will cause. Because if they don't and the product causes widespread harm, what's going to happen? They're going to end up financially upside down. I'm not saying they won't put a product out that causes harm, but they want to make sure that they have visibility into the harm. They can disclose the harm so they don't get failure to warn claims. They want to be able to design it as safe as they can so they don't get hit with design defect claims. And that they're going to end up financially in the black given the safety profile of the product. Hence, most drugs are licensed based on multi-year placebo-controlled trials. Most drugs are licensed that way because the pharma companies are altruistic, because they're moral, because they're ethical, because they want to do the right thing, because they care about people, because the government made them. None of that stuff. All that stuff is nonsense. Anybody who's been in a publicly traded company boardroom understands that's not how things work in the real world. Okay? And that's fine, by the way, because normally the economic interest aligns with those things. So with the drug, because they're financially liable, they're more likely to do the moral, ethical, right thing because they have the economic interest to do it. And hence they design their trials accordingly. But with vaccines, since they don't have that exposure, they don't have to worry about the liability, nor even actually the PR issues because of what the government promotes for them. You end up with these ridiculous trials of often days or weeks of licensure, often days a week of safety review after injection, without any proper control group, and often underpowered, not enough kids. So think about that, and that is a real world effect of taking away the immunity. If you would restore immunity to the liability to the pharma companies who make these vaccine products, you're going to see very different clinical trials. I would be shocked if they would have let Combivax HB or Engerix B or Gardasil, or go down the list of all the vaccines on the childhood schedule right now. The HIV vaccines, the IPV vaccines, the pneumococcal vaccines, all of them on the market with the ridiculous clinical trials that they actually use. And so that has a real dangerous downstream impact, that immunity. And so, and it's why I call it the original sin.
Wow. Well, let's also then, maybe you could kind of explain the role of punitive damages in sort of the economic calculation, an example like the Pinto.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, the Pinto is a great example where in discovery, which you aren't going to get with a typical, almost ever with a vaccine, right? It's oftentimes, how do you prove the car, you know, the manufacturer knew about the harm, or how do you prove the drug really caused the harm? Oftentimes it's in discovery, right? You get it from the internal documents of the company. You're not going to get that typically with vaccines because you can't sue them for the most part. Mm. But going to the example of the Pinto, in discovery, what they found was the Pinto, the gas tank on some of the cars would explode, burning the people inside alive or severely maiming them. Both very bad outcomes. They were sued for that outcome, because Congress didn't give them immunity, despite how important cars are. And in that lawsuit, in one of these lawsuits, what they found was an internal memo within the company that did an economic analysis. And it found that The amount it would have to pay for the people that it killed, burned alive, and maimed from their cars exploding would be less than what they would have to pay to correct the issue. And they knew how to correct the issue. There was a fix for it. But to recall all the cars and do that fix on the gas tanks so that this would not happen anymore, doesn't happen much today, it would cost more. So they didn't do it. And here's the problem. When you think about punitive damage, when you think about if you didn't have punitive damages in that scenario, and this is the scenario that punitive damage is designed for, in that situation, the company would still not fix it even if they paid out all the damages. They wouldn't fix it, right? Because they still are going to pay less to pay out all the victims versus fix it. Punitive damages are intended to make it so that the economic pain is greater by not fixing the problem. And that was the purpose of punitive damages. That is, it is a way to compensate for the economics, the fact that in that scenario, the economic forces were not sufficient to result in the change needed to make the product safer without punitive damages. Think about vaccines. Forget punies. You can't get anything against them. Think about what their conduct looks like. Well, you don't need to think about it. I mean, really, just go on the FDA website and just start by looking at what's relied upon to license child vaccines. If you haven't, you will be horrified. You should be anyway.
Stamp Seed is the most analog object in your Bitcoin stack. No batteries, no firmware, no third-party trust. Just a titanium DIY kit that lets you hammer your seed words into solid metal. Fire resistant, waterproof, crush proof. The simplest, dumbest, most reliable backup for the most important sense you'll ever own. Stampseed.com, code MATRIX for 15% off. I set up my own Firefish account, and I'll tell you exactly why. I've spent years on this show telling people don't sell. Low time preference, hold the line. And then you live long enough and life hands you a reason. A down payment, a business, a kid. And you're sitting there staring at your stack thinking, am I about to break my own rule? Firefish was the first thing I found that let me keep it. You put up your Bitcoin as collateral. You get the liquidity you need, and you never give up custody. Your keys stay in multi-sig. Nobody's relending your coins behind your back. You don't have to choose between living your life and keeping your stack. And that's the whole point. Don't sell your Bitcoin. Live off it. First Loans, 30% off your fees. Firefish.io/ref equals matrix. Code matrix. Links in the show notes. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we kind of on this show, we talk about don't trust, verify, do your own research. What about the primary sources? How do someone become an informed user of vaccines? Is there informed consent in all of these vaccines?
Yeah. So here's what I would say on that, okay? Everybody's got limited time. We all do, right? Every time I go and buy a product, I don't have the time to go and become an expert in cars and the engines and the pistons and, you know, what is the safest mechanisms to use and go down the list of every other product out there. If we had to really become an expert or really understand in a deep level those products, we would have no time for anything else. Good news is that for most products, you don't need to do that because the market will adjust for the safety issues in the way that it did for the Pinto. Cars have gotten safer because the manufacturers are constantly liable, even for silly things like peeling paint, okay? My firm has a lawsuit for paint peeling on a certain brand of cars, right? So they're like, they don't want that paint to peel. I will tell you, if they had immunity for paint peeling, all cars would peel, okay? I'm telling you right now, it would peel. So that's the degree of comfort you get. When the airbags don't work right, they get sued. When the roll cage is not properly designed, they get sued. When the crush, you know, where there isn't properly, you go down the list of it all, right? They get sued. Or more importantly, and this is the most important part, is that they know they'll be sued. And that conforms their conduct so they never get sued. So it's the invisible hand of that economic potential liability that drives their conduct without you seeing it, okay? I'm not giving credit to the lawyers, just to be clear, okay? I'm giving credit to the market force. That's very different than a lawsuit. It's not about lawsuits. Lawsuits are where they fall out of line. It's the specter of liability. And that can come from a lawsuit. It can come from having to do a recall voluntarily because they know there'll be a liability. It's from the market force, okay? Everybody out there, you can still despise lawyers. It's fine. It's the market force that I'm giving credit to, not lawyers. Okay. Remind me your question. I lost track. I'm sorry.
We were talking about, I think, informed consent.
Oh, right. Informed consent. I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. So for every other product, the market force will do, but there's really one major exception to that. There's actually another exception that, because of the recent Supreme Court decision when it comes to pesticides and herbicides and stuff like that, that I can get into. But for the most part, there's really one product where you have to do your own homework because the market force will never correct. And those are vaccines. The product that if you have a child out there, the CDC schedule now has injected 29 times into your child on or before their first birthday. It's not about like some random product in your home. This is something you should take very, very seriously. I'm not telling anybody what to do. They should make their own choice. But I can tell you that, as a firm that represents folks whose child's been injured by these products, you know, I've been in way too many rooms with parents who've, they're angry or they're crying or they're upset that they never even took a second to research it. They just said, yeah, sure, jab them up. And with these products, you can't do that. You've got to do it. And so the place to get informed so you can make a decision from a place of knowledge you can go to icandecide.org. They have a section called Get Informed. That's icandecide.org. And there's a bunch of free resources there. There's like a 2-page write-up, a 10-page write-up, 20-page, whatever you're... There's even a long exchange with the federal health authorities about vaccine safety you can read. You can also read my book. And then there's other resources from there. But those are the two that I would recommend. I'm biased. But here's the part that I actually find the most important about informed consent. It's not the informed part, okay? Because if I walk in and I'm a parent and I say, I just love vaccines. I trust my doctors implicitly. I don't care what the package said. I don't care what the clinical trial. I don't care what post-licensure. I don't care about any of it. Doctor, jab the kid up, okay? Or, you were informed to the degree you want, and then you consented. And in some ways, you know, that's not the legal definition of informed consent, just to be clear, in many states, okay? A doctor does have a duty under state laws to inform you to a certain degree, depending on the state. But, you know, you were informed and you consented in the manner that you wanted. The problem I have is where I really take issue is the consent part, okay? It's the parent who is knowledgeable. It's the parent who read all the primary sources, is really informed about these products, and then doesn't want to consent. So they've been informed. They are choosing not to consent. And then they're told, hey, okay, no problem. But now your kid can't go to school, or you can't have a job, or you can't be part of public civil society. Well, then the consent's not worthwhile. That is destructive to consent. And that's where we focus our civil individual rights work, is on the consent component of it and the informed part too. But, you know, on the informed part, you know, with ICANN's website, my book, and lots of other books, like there's a lot of great books out there. Dr. Sears has a book. Dr. Gator has a book out. There's so many books out there you can read about this. There's so many nonprofits that put information out there about this. You can get informed if you want. The problem is on the consent part, is that if the, when the government steps in and says you can't have your rights, even no matter how informed you are. And I will tell you, the parents who make an informed decision on this topic, right, who really, who've come around the bend and decided they don't want to vaccinate their children, which is not an easy, light decision most people make. Most people don't wake up and go, you know what I want to do today? I want to take a socially ostracizing position that might get my kids kicked out of school, me kicked out of job. I'll be called an anti-science, anti-vaxxer. Go down the list. My friends won't want to hang out with me. I'll be thrown out of polite society in Manhattan because, you know, that's not accepted there, or, you know, and so forth. That's not a decision made lightly. That's often one made with, often there's an personal experience that that person or somebody they know has had, plus they have researched it. It usually takes both of those to get there. And once they've researched it and they've seen with their own eyes the clinical trial data, you can't unlearn that. You can't undo that, right? And then when they want to make that decision and say no, the pediatrician, society, the government officials, who from my depositions of them is clear they know far less than that parent. I've never met or deposed a pediatrician, any pediatrician, any. I've even deposed pediatricians from universities that train pediatricians, that I've never found one that knows more than the what I would call the typical, the average informed parent who has chosen not to vaccinate, who that knows more about these products.
Yeah. I mean, I think for myself, the journey is you grow up and you're kind of getting vaccines. At least I was. My parents took me to get them. And then when I turned 18, you start having to make choices for yourself, whether it's like the flu vaccine, which was sort of very, I felt pushed in corporate America and the cities and sort of in terms of messaging and institutional capture. And then I remember even trying to travel. I think I don't know if I was required to get certain vaccines to travel. Then you have your own kids and you start wondering about, now it's a very different thing. It's something you're consenting to maybe for yourself, but you know, what kind of choices, and there's no real give backs with the kids, you know, and then, COVID, you know, depending on where you are in your personal journey, when that hit, how old you are. So sorts of lots of inflection points. One thing I think that was, you know, illuminating in your book and I started to see was just, there seems to be certain core beliefs around vaccines. You know, such things like, do vaccines save millions from harm and do they prevent transmission? And even this, it's, you know, there's sort of, it's hard to kind of come to good information and primary sources and make good decisions for yourself. What could you say about those kinds of issues?
Sure. You know, I mean, the type of data and evidence that I often type rely upon is what I would call admissions against interest. If somebody who is opposed to vaccines publishes a study that says something positive about vaccines, it's most likely to be, you know, have a higher degree of reliability. If somebody who is proponent of vaccines publishes something negative about vaccines, similarly, right? You know, because they're less likely to do it. They're trying to find a way not to do it, right? An admission against interest. And so, when it comes to, well, how many people would die if we had no vaccines right now in America? Right. And one way to gauge that is, well, how many people died in the year prior to the introduction of each of the vaccines we routinely use right now? Right. And I lay that out in my book. When you add all of that up, and a lot of these vaccines were introduced long ago, before acute medical care, before a lot of the things that have reduced mortality, you don't get millions. You don't get hundreds of thousands. You don't get tens of thousands. Right. You don't even get high thousands. You get what is nowhere near what they claim is the number, and that helps start putting perspective on this. Measles, and that's not to say no vaccine can have any benefit. They can, but you have to do it in proportion to, you have to do a proper weighing of the benefits versus the risks. There are some people for whom 100% guaranteed the risks outweigh the benefits, because if they die from the vaccine, they get seriously injured from the vaccine, for example. Right. Well, for that person, the benefits did not outweigh the risks. And then you'll say, well, on a population level, well, first of all, medicine should be to the individual. But even on a population level, when you look at these numbers, their claims about mortality are off by a factor of 99.999%. And I just show that with the basic CDC data, the CDC's own data on mortality by vaccine. Then you the question of transmission you just brought up, for example. Most vaccines do not stop infection and transmission. The quintessential thing they say, the reason they give to crush and take away your civil individual rights, the ability for you to make your own choice in this country about whether you want to get something injected in your body and still be able to go to school, participate in civil society, doesn't do the very thing they claim it does as the basis for taking away all those rights, which is stop transmission. And that's true of numerous vaccines. In fact, some of them do the opposite, like pertussis vaccine. If you get a pertussis shot, you are actually, it will reduce the symptoms. It does have that effect for a certain period of time in some people, but it doesn't do anything to stop transmission. And who published that? Who said that? The industry's own leading scientists, paid consultants, found that. Oh, that's a heck of an admission against interest. And also, it makes a lot of sense because it doesn't create any mucosal immunity. Immunity in your linings, the pertussis bacterium is in your nasopharynx. If there's no immunity here in your mucosal lining, it's going to keep replicating. It just might have some type other type of immunity, different kind of antibodies like IgG antibodies that are off circulating blood that might reduce symptoms. But what it's not doing is it's not stopping you becoming infected. Now, if you have less symptoms and your equal amount of carriage, who's likely to transmit it? The person that knows they have symptoms and stays in bed, or the person with no symptoms and is still a carrier? Of course, the person with no symptoms. And so, you know, pertussis vaccine is makes you more likely to transmit that. And another reason, since you got folks on here who like economics, if the science doesn't persuade you, maybe economics will. We actually, there was a television commercial, as we filed a class action lawsuit against a pharmaceutical company that had this advertisement that if you were a grandparent and you didn't get a pertussis vaccine, in the commercial, you turn into a wolf, you know, eating your grandchild. Like, you're going to kill your grandchild if you don't get this product. Well, we sued them on a class action basis. And as we, you know, as the complaint made clear and citing their own scientists said, actually, the grandma who gets the shot is less likely to know she has pertussis, hence more likely to pick up her baby and spread pertussis to her newborn child. And not only that, the vaccine causes a defective form of immunity that renders the grandma susceptible to be infected over and over and over again, where the grandma who never got the shot, if she gets it, she knows she has it once, and it is not susceptible to be repeatedly infected because of something called original antigenic sin. Not going to get into the science of it. You know how long after we filed that class in law, we forget litigated it, just filed it. That whole advertising campaign was no longer around. Weeks. Gone. Why? That wasn't about injury in a way, right? It wasn't about injury in a way. It was about efficacy of the product, and it was about false advertising in a commercial. They decided to affirmatively go out to the market and do this advertising, which they normally don't do. They usually leave it to the CDC and FDA to promote their products. So if the science doesn't persuade you, maybe the economics and the reaction to that class action lawsuit that shows you the impact and the power of being able to hold a company liable for potentially, you know, when you can allege false claims against them and you can survive a motion to dismiss, as we did in that lawsuit. And we've actually now settled it, and it's going through the settlement process in terms of getting, we got preliminary approval and going through final approval. So, that's another example of, what you're told about these products and what the reality is. And then there's, on the safety side, not the efficacy side, you know, there's the pre and post licensure safety and the claim that these things are the most robustly, thoroughly studied products out there is, to anybody who actually understands what the clinical trials are and what the post licensure looks like, that's not just a debatable question. That's a joke of it is a categorically false claim. I shouldn't be so glib about it. It is categorically false. And if I could sue federal officials for making that claim, I'd be very rich.
Wow. What about misconceptions, or like maybe the a different version of measles or polio that most people are familiar with?
What do you mean, different version?
In terms of, most people think, you know, polio is a fantastic example of a vaccine that came in and just knocked that back, and And maybe there's kind of, I've always heard about measles being the worst thing ever.
So, so measles is, measles is the one that you always hear about as being like the dread of society. Everybody's going to die if you don't get a measles vaccine. Now, here's the thing about the measles vaccine. Measles vaccine actually can stop transmission. Okay, it's one of the few that can. MMR and the chickenpox vaccine can stop transmission. And so if you get that product, you're less likely to get measles, which means you're less likely to get harm from the measles virus. Okay? And that's where the public health officials want you to stop talking. They want you to shut up after that, right? That's it. No more talking. Okay. Because, and that's a reality. But there's more reality to the reality of that reality. That reality is this much reality. And then there's the bigger picture that you have to step back to if you actually care about reality. And it's this. Number one, measles is not the major, the killer in a country like the United States that they claim it is. And the vaccine is not the great savior that everyone thinks it is. And I can prove it to you with some very basic CDC data. Number one, between 1900 and the introduction of the first measles vaccine in 1963, the very first one in this country, the mortality from measles declined by over 98%. Okay? You know what didn't cause that reduction, Cedric? Measles vaccine. Because it didn't exist. Simple. What did not cause that reduction? Measles vaccine. What will you always hear public health officials attribute that decline to? Measles vaccine. Now, here's the part that's ironic. Public health officials probably can take credit for most of that decline. Better sanitation, better living conditions, better acute care. Go down the list. Okay? So they could, but they never do. They always want to point to a product that didn't exist. Now, in the few years leading up to 1963, we did not have, you would think that a million people died in America from measles every year, right? Before there was a vaccine. You would think hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, thousands, 900, 500? No, it was around 400 people a year. Every death is a tragedy. Do not get me wrong. But 400 deaths a year is a tiny, minuscule, almost percent of the overall mortality. Back then, I mean, we have about 3 million people die a year. So that's 400 out of the 3 million. And back then, you actually, in the early, here's an interesting stat. In the late 50s, early 60s, you had about... about 4.2 million new births a year, where today I think you have 3.8 million. No, 3.2 million versus 2.8 million. You had more births per year then than you do now. Think about that. Think about that number for a second, okay? So you had about 400 deaths, which translates at a time when there was no measles vaccine, at a time when everybody in America got measles. That translates to 450,000 Americans before there was measles vaccine dying of measles in the late 50s, early 60s. Every death is a tragedy, but we got to have perspective, okay? It is not this great killer that it is. Now, in developing countries where you have poor sanitation, no clean water, bad nutrition, no acute care, any infection will kill a child, including measles. So you'll have higher mortality from every infection. But it shows you what America shows you and what the United Kingdom shows you, by the way. For example, where they didn't introduce a measles vaccine until 1968, their mortality from measles from 1900 to 1967 declined by over 99%. So they had a few more years to continue that decline, all right? People who like numbers and charts, stats, right? Bitcoin up, down, right? Like, just basic data, hard data, what I just said. It gets worse for the proponents of vaccines once you have to factor in reality. And it's this. So now we're down to, we got 400 deaths, which is, you know, that decline, that curve, mortality decline curve, there's no reason to presume it would not have continued. pockets of this country in the late 50s, early 60s were still like a developing country. Those have improved. Acute care hasn't changed. It ain't gotten better. Nothing's improved. We're still in the late 50s? No. Even those 400 deaths, a portion of that decline is still likely attributable to the very factors that would have continued to cause the decline beforehand. But let's just assume for a moment that the entire reduction of that 400 deaths is from the measles vaccine. Now you got to step back and go, okay, well, what's the harm to society that this product has caused? And I'm just going to give you one study and then I'm going to stop. It is this. There was a prospective, forward-looking, meaning highly reliable study of over 100,000 people in Japan that looked at those that had measles and mumps versus those that did not. It was funded by the Japanese government, done by major institutions. And it found that those that had measles and mumps, okay, had a statistically significant, far less lowered risk from dying from cardiovascular disease. In fact, about 14% of the men after 20 years had died of a cardiovascular disease that did not have measles and mumps, and only 7% of the men that had measles and mumps died of cardiovascular disease. That is a massive differential. And it was statistically significant in the study. Cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of Americans today. 900,000 Americans. If eliminating measles and mumps, which had been around for forever, has been even 1% of that increased mortality in cardiovascular disease, you are upside down on your risk benefit, even on a life years lost basis, because obviously a child dying versus an adult dying, there's different loss in life years, but you're still upside down even on a life lost years basis. It could be. I'm not saying it is. I'll leave it to the evolutionary biologists and others to do all of their speculating, but I will ask them to speculate on this. Many pathogens have come and gone throughout the ages. Many have come and gone. Measles didn't, mumps didn't, and maybe that's because it conferred a survival advantage on those who got it. Because studies show not only that those who've had measles and mumps are less likely to die of cardiovascular disease, they're also less likely to die of various cancers. Kids that have had, and adults that have had measles, for example, those that have not had measles, have a 66% increased rate of non-Hodgkin lymphoma and I believe 133% increased rate of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, statistically significant in a study out of a major university. And about 20,000 Americans die from Hodgkin's lymphoma every year in the United States. Half the rate of ovarian cancer if you've had measles, for example. And so, these are smaller retrospective studies, right? But they're uniform, and there's lots of them. They're just inconvenience. You never hear about them. I cite them all and go through them in my book. And so you can very quickly see that maybe these febrile fever-inducing childhood infections conferred a survival advantage and why they never went away. My point here is this. Is that there's a bigger picture to be had on the measles vaccine. And when you step back and you look at what was the actual risk from measles in the years before there was a measles vaccine, you look at what is the effect of measles on the society and what is the harm from the product itself, which I didn't even touch, right? Kids can die from measles vaccine. Kids can get encephalopathy, brain damage from measles vaccine. Brain damage is exactly where the CDC used on its vaccine information statement about the measles vaccine. Not my words. Their words. So in any event, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, a lot to unpack here. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all this with us. My final question for you is I noticed you have I read the book and you have a chapter about supporting individual rights. And I guess that'd be the backdrop. So like, where do you think we are now? And, you know, I guess you interviewed Plotkin in 2018.
I believe it was. Yep.
So as an individual in 2020, the world there must have been some dots to connect there, just what you learned in 2019 about vaccines, and now there's a new kind of vaccine. And then as a country, we all went through, or as a world, we all went through that. And so I feel like, where do you see we are as a country right now in this conversation just about kids and vaccines and adults and grandparents? Are we... in this, are we in a battle right now, or are things better than they were 5-6 years ago, or are things unclear? What can someone do to, other than just kind of do their own research and make decisions in their own best interest? Is there a community conversation going on right now? Is there something people should be aware of? I'm just trying to tap into the greater pulse here. Where do you think we are?
I think things are moving in the right directions. Look, they're a product. You want to get them? This is America. That's freedom. I support everybody's right to get as many vaccines as they want. You want to get a flu shot every day, a COVID shot every other day? You should be free to do that. You want to wear 17 masks and you want to live in a self-imposed stay at home in your basement? That's freedom. You're 18, you're totally healthy, and you want to do all that, you should be able to do it. And if you're 90 and you're a war veteran and you want to go to the coffee shop with no mask and no vaccine and get a latte, you should be able to do that as well. And no government official should be able to tell you otherwise. That business is free to close if they want. That business should be able to stay open if they want. So if that business wants to stay open, they should be able to do it. And I hope that the lesson we've learned is this. The virus is not what ruined our economy. Viruses don't have that power. It's the government that did that. It's the government that closed the schools. It's the government that closed the businesses. It's the government that made people stay home. It's the government that made people wear face diapers. It's the government that forced injections into their bodies that may have not wanted. They should have been free to do all of that if you wanted. Private schools should have been free to close if they want. Businesses should have been free to do it if they want. And if you want to stay at home, you should. But I'm hoping the lesson learned is that we should never cede those rights to the government, ever, ever, right? They should be able to recommend, but they should never have the power to be able to tell you, to be able to crush, literally crush your individual civil rights. And the hearing going on with Fauci right now, to me, has nothing to do with Fauci. It has to do with the line that he crossed, that no government official should cross. And I'm hoping the lesson that comes out of this to every public health official out there is, recommend to your heart's content, try to persuade on the merits, but never infringe on anybody's civil individual rights. And I think people are, a growing percentage of the country is waking up to that. Certainly we can see that in about half the states, there are laws that are, they're either laws passed, executive orders, or judicial decisions that are protecting that right with regards to masks and COVID vaccines, certain other vaccines and so forth. And it's not about the products. It's about protecting those rights. And then the other part of it is that I think people are waking up to use an odd word, but humanize vaccines and understand they're a product and treat them like a product. Okay. Because once you treat them like an item of worship, you can't have discourse. You can't debate. I bet if somebody out there who likes vaccines is listening to this, they might have had an emotional reaction. And if you did to some of the things I said, ask yourself why. Why are you having an emotional reaction to my statements about a product, right? It's because a lot of times people's views on these products comes from their beliefs, not their intellect. And that can cause cognitive dissonance and they react with emotion. So in any event, I think we're going in the right direction on those fronts. I think we've seen there are a lot of public figures out there who are who understand the issues and are pushing forward. And, you know, I think that over time it will come to a head. And I hope, and my sincere hope is that this comes to a head before there's a calamity that's needed to get it there. Because unfortunately, reform often happens in the face of serious calamities. Apparently, 1 in 4 people, according to the Rasmussen poll, saying that they know somebody that died of COVID vaccine was not enough to get change. So, you know, what's that number need to be? Does it need to be 1 in 3, 1 in 2? I hope it's not 1 in 1. You know, I hope that, you know, our public health officials, our legislatures around the country, state and federal, the judicial process will become more in tune with what these issues are and will adjudicate and pass laws accordingly.
I agree. Thank you so much again for coming on the show. I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you and your work and the book, of course.
Sure. AaronSiriOfficial.com is where you can find the collection of all of the media stuff my media people put together or whatever that is, you know, so you can find it there. I'm also, you know, on Twitter, AaronSiriSG and so forth. So, But, you know, for anybody out there, I do, you know, if you've never really looked at this issue, you've never touched upon it, take a little time, you know, get a little educated on it. You know, certainly before you inject, get, you know, just I would take a little bit of time to get knowledgeable about it. Read at least the 2-page summary about vaccine safety on ICANDecide.org if you're going to do nothing else. And for those who are already informed about it and understand the issues, don't be shy about speaking about it. If everybody out there who has issue with these products spoke truth about what they know and weren't afraid, we would have turned the corner already. Because just from the volume of intakes, my firm alone gets tens of thousands of folks who contact about serious vaccine injuries. And by the way, Cedric, you know how I know they're not anti-vaxxers, so to speak, the anti-vaxxers? Because they got the vaccine. They wouldn't be calling me for vaccine injury. You know, if all of the, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. If all of these folks were, you know, were not scared of being labeled, not scared of the pejorative, not scared of the multi-billion dollar machine that is put out by the federal health agencies and pharma companies to create the environment in which it is, you should, they want you to be afraid to speak out on this topic, right? They love me, of course. You should see, they put out all kinds of positive billboards about me. New York Times, I'm sure they get, they just happen to have the coverage that they all in lockstep have about the work we do. I'm sure it's just happenstance. You know, I'm sure nothing to do with PR agencies and so forth. But if everybody out there who understood it spoke out, it does make a difference because you get to educate the next person next to you. And it's not like there's a few of those who have a concern or and who have some knowledge about it. There are many, many folks out there. I meet them all the time when I go speak in massive crowds. You know, I say, because I often start my speeches, Cedric, where I say, okay, who knows about this? And you'll see hundreds of people raising their hand. I'm like, oh, they all know. You know, they know. I mean, that's a large crowd in a random city in, or a small city in America that all know if they all, you know, were not concerned. And I understand it doesn't come without risk. But if everybody did it at once, there'd be safety in numbers. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, thank you so much. Be well.
Thank you.
Hey, that's a wrap on the latest episode of the Bitcoin Matrix. If this one added value, share it with one person who needs to hear it. That's how the Bitcoin Matrix grows. None of this happens without our sponsors, Stampseed, Firefish, and Club Orange, companies I personally use and genuinely believe in. Follow me on X at Sed Youngelman and the show at _Bitcoin Matrix. We're in the conversation every single day. Stay humble, keep stacking, spend your time well. It's the one thing you can't get back. And keep your head on a swivel out there. This is Sed. Now escape the Matrix.